for tuning in. I appreciate your time. Hope you're having a good day wherever you are. We've got amazing guests, extraordinary people, a lot of, I believe, inspiring things happening in our world today. I am so lucky I get to talk to some of these people who are giving us food for thought in so many different ways and new ways of connecting with our world and our reality. Jim Pathfinder Ewing, you may be familiar with his work. He had another book on Reiki shamanism, and I believe the book right now is brand new, so you may not have seen it, but that's what we're talking about right now. It's Conscious Food, Sustainable Growing, Spiritual Eating. Hi there, Jim Pathfinder Ewing.
Hi, Wendy.
Okay, now how'd you get your name, Pathfinder? Was this a Native American given to you, or how did that come about?
Yeah, that was, this is my sixth book, so all these things kind of go back a little ways. In 1992, I'll try to give you a short version. In 1992, I shattered my left leg. I fell out of a tree, and I went through some excruciating times with Western medicine, I'd learned how to walk all over again. I had to take, a lot of painkillers and things like that. It wasn't really working for me. And so that really, as I write in Reiki shamanism, that really turned out to be a blessing because it put me on the healing path, and I learned a lot of different natural ways, for healing. And a lot of that was connecting with Native American spirituality, and I had some really good teachers, and one of them gave me the name of Pathfinder, Nehi Wadiji, which is in Cherokee, one who finds the path, and it's generally given to someone who has been down many paths, some of them not so good ones, mm-hmm. and so that he can give good advice on ways to go. And of course, it means a lot of different things other than just one thing. Nehi is the immortal, so it's also showing the way towards spirit, a path towards spirit, a way toward your true self, things like that. So the name is both describes who I am and also what is expected of me. So so I try to live up to that name. And one of the greatest honors you can have in Native American society, or traditional Native American society, is to be given a name that others have had and that has been worn well, so that you can fulfill that name. So for me, it describes who I am and what I do, and the good and the bad and everything. And I think it's been a pretty good name, and I like it, so I carry it.
Liking it also helps.
I'm sorry, what?
Liking it also helps. It resonates,
yeah, well,
you know?
Yeah, well, that's true. But it's kind of one of those things you can't really escape. It's some of those things that are really true are things that if you turn your back on them, they're just going to keep tapping you on the shoulder until you pay attention.
Okay, now the book, you give a lot of credit, or, you source a lot of material from Rudolf Steiner.
Yes.
And I thought that was very telling as well. Can you give us a background on that connection?
Yes. Rudolf Steiner is the founder of biodynamic farming, which in the book I'm not necessarily saying that people have to follow or practice biodynamic farming. It's a way of farming. It's a way of natural farming. And he had a series of talks called the Agriculture Course that he gave back around the turn of the century in the early 1900s. And the reason I source him is because he was so far ahead of his time as far as seeing the dangers and spiritual difficulties of industrial agriculture. He predicted quite rightly that industrial agriculture would destroy the fabric of people's connection with the land and people's connection with the food and with the spiritual connection of things that we don't even know what they are, the spiritual beings of the world. And so he was the first, Western philosopher who saw this And unfortunately, he wasn't heeded. He was a part of the Theosophical movement. Up until that time, he had been seen as one of the leaders of the of science. He was a scientist. And he was heralded as a great scientist. But because he had beliefs in the that were part of the Theosophical movement, he was excluded and ostracized by the scientific community as being kind of too far out or whatnot. Nowadays, most of what he said would be considered mainstream. There's, I mean, it would be something that you would read in a in any type of metaphysical book or anything about spirituality, anything about energy medicine, all these things. He's really kind of a hidden father of both metaphysics and a scientific way of looking at metaphysics. And so I begin the book speaking about him because he was the most modern philosopher of a spiritual way of seeing the world and trying to accommodate and to also warn about the dangers of what you might say is runaway science or runaway technology. And so that's why I start off with him.
Well, and it's brought us to this present that we are, where we have the GMO. We have all of this stuff that is basically focusing on bigger and not necessarily more nutritious, but just a bigger product that will, and I guess lots of it, volume and size is the focus rather than the content and the nutritional value. Also, the fact that it can be in some way, shape, or form patented. So once you have the perfect seed, nobody else can use it unless they pay you buku bucks.
Absolutely. It's a runaway train. And what prompted me to write this book was all these. My wife and I have a small organic farm, and one day I was out there and I was working in the field, and it was so beautiful. I mean, I was out there working. The sky was blue and the wind was blowing, and you know, I was out there with my hands in the soil, and I was just so thankful. I mean, it just came upon me what a beautiful, beautiful thing this was. To be out there growing, not only growing our own food, but producing food that we lovingly prepared and we sold at a place that we love and we enjoy to people who we know and that they enjoyed it. And there was this beautiful circle of love with the food. And I was thinking, this is so beautiful. It's so wonderful. It's a living prayer to be able to do this, to be a participant in this. And then I came back in the house and I got on the computer. And there was a scare about some kind of meat or something, and Annette and I had been buying this. We're not vegetarian. I'd say we limit our amount of meat, but we're not vegetarian or vegan. And one of the things that we had bought was a buffalo meat because it has such good, tremendous, has a very grain fed and all like this. And we bought. There's only one place you could get, and that was at Kroger. And we bought this because we thought it was organic. We thought it was, or at least was raised in the right way, and it was one of those on the recall list. So I got to looking to see. Well, you know, I thought this was range fed. You know, I thought it was, and so I got to looking. And what they'd use little weasel words about, you know, how it was all natural food and this and that. So it didn't really mean anything. You know, made me angry because what they had sold us was something that was false, and not only that, but was on part of the recall list, and because of the strain of E. coli, proved that it was in a feedlot because that particular strain is what's in the gut of ruminants who are being fed corn. So I knew that they had lied, and it really made me angry. And it made me angry to think that food was going out there that not only were there lies about it, but it was dangerous. And I was thinking, well, why am I'm out there working, and it had such feelings of love and completeness, and then I'm brought in here, and every day we're pounded with unhealthy food, with food that's killing people, food that, you know, you can't trust it, food that that people are fearful. They don't know if what they're getting is going to hurt them or not. And here, like with the GMO vote in California, where it got defeated because of misinformation and lies. And so we're being fed all this stuff, and that against a backdrop of food as being such a beautiful, wonderful, intimate thing and spiritual. And so I thought, well, how did it get this way? How did we come to a point in our lives that we're fearful of food, and that food is unhealthy, and that you have to live like this? And how did we get away from it being such a beautiful thing? And so that was the point of the book, you know, the starting point of the book. And of course, you read it, and the first part of it is going down through history about, spirit and food. And if you look at it, you see that only in the last 2,000 years has our real spiritual, intimate spiritual connection with food been lost since the time of the Romans. And if you look, and even then, you have to put a little asterisk on that, because in Native American society, when the first Europeans came to America, food still was very much treated as a spiritual thing and was part of the fabric of life. And you see the difference, that one of the major differences in how this changed was through patriarchal society. If you look at the goddess societies, which predated Roman culture and Roman Empire, you see that in goddess cultures, food was treated as a sacred thing and was part of the fabric of the community. But then with the rise of patriarchal society, you have food being treated as a weapon of war and of scarcity and lack. And so that's where we get, that's where it starts. But of course, it's developed, or the gap is widened until you get to a point where you have Rudolf Steiner, who's saying, "Look, we're on the threshold here of losing our last vestiges of connection of spirit with food."
See, that's what I think is interesting. And, it kind of raises up the point that now we are living in the land of might versus right. So anybody who has the power and the economy, the funds, can control pretty much everything, the propaganda, the labeling, the contents, everything. And then those of us on the bottom end of the food chain are slowly seeing all of our value and our worth being compartmentalized into, are you promoting this by using it so that you can keep the hospitals full and all of that, continue the production line. It's a never-ending source, and it's all going in one direction, and that would be, in my view, to extinction, which I think we're trying to quickly say by getting the word out and the ways that you're doing it. When you mentioned the patriarchal, that approach, patriarchal society, it had to do with the Native Americans valued the way their culture was set up. The women had a very, very strong input. It wasn't just one gender saying this is how it will run and that's the way it is. It was a community, and in a lot of the indigenous societies, they include the older people, they include the younger people, they include those who are not necessarily representation of the mainstream. That's a different viewpoint that somehow in our society has been antiquated, lost, relegated to this doesn't work for us and it won't make us rich.
That's right, and actually, it's really completion of a circle in a way that we have an opportunity to do right now, in that, as you say, in Native American society, in traditional Native American society, at least in the eastern half of the country, women owned everything. They were the property owners. They were they owned all the farms and the crops. Men were, this matrilineal society, and it was female oriented. It was what we're moving back toward too right now is a matrifocal society, and that is where the decisions, if you look, in marketing and so forth, women are the ones who make the decisions in the family. Those are the ones that make the biggest buying decisions and so forth. And so it's kind of a slumbering power that people aren't really aware of. And so but those are the ones that the marketers aim at. And so as a question of empowerment, is bringing mindful choices back to our food. And that's why, you know, in the second half of the book, I go into how we can turn this around, change it. And it harkens back to the beginning on the matrifocal part or matrilineal part. As Robert McIlvaine, historian, says, women invented agriculture. You know, when agriculture started, it was women who did it. And like here in Native American society, and when the first Europeans came, that's the way it was here. That's the way it was all over the world back before 2,000 years ago. And that was where societies were based upon and around the food and the choices that were made by women for their families, for their children, for their parents, and so forth. And that was the focus of life, really. And it was a spiritual way of living. It's a way of nurture and wholeness rather than a division and separation. Today we have division and separation in those prehistoric or pre-Columbian and so forth societies. It was a different type of society as a wholeness, a whole culture.
Well, so, the part that you draw a correlation to, that women were making the farm, and then when they found that activity self-fulfilling and a necessity, then the guys went to work because they didn't have anything else to do.
That's right. That's right. Like, Wazavi is another historian, said that that when men get bored, they create war. So
they didn't have TV, okay? They didn't have TV or professional sports, so they had to do something else. And now that TV's here, that might be a good distraction.
That's right. But what I argue for in the book is that that we can turn this around, though, in that by recognizing our choices and mindful choices and through something that I call biocultural revolution. Now, biocultural evolution is a scientific theory, that culture affects people and people affect culture, and that the world, more broadly still, environment affects people and people affect the environment. And it's credited with why we have modern Homo sapiens today, in that the reason the first hominids developed into societies is because they had a couple of things that were different from their cousins, and that was that they had a little bit more social skills, and they had a little bit longer adolescence. And what this meant was that that they could communicate to each other and learn. And one of the things they learned was food that was good for them and food that was not good for them. And this was knowledge that was passed down. And so what happened was that through their choices, their biocultural choices, through choosing food that had a higher caloric content and so forth, that they grew bigger brains and had greater reasoning ability, and consequently they could make even better choices, and they could also, they developed other skills such as better communication and so forth. And so what happened was that through this interaction between genetics and the environment, each feeding across the other, that they became what is today modern reasoning, intellectual human beings. So, and that's called biocultural evolution. Now, if we look at our food and our food choices, what we're seeing is that biocultural evolution is not working for us very well right now, not through choices, but through the available choices. And that is that if you look at all the diseases that are happening, they're commonplace among our children, of obesity and growing into adults that are having cardiovascular diseases, hypertension, and so forth. And some people are saying this may be the first generation in modern history that the children will live shorter lifespans because of it than their parents. And that's a major, huge thing. That biocultural evolution that we're seeing is because of the choices that are being made available to us. And that is, you know, like high salt, high fat, all those things that are not good for you and cause these things. What I argue for is biocultural revolution, and that is by making mindful choices and developing among your friends, your family, your churches, and so forth, that you demand that you know what's in your food, that you demand that you have labeling on GMO, that you choose not to buy things that are unhealthful, that you choose to buy things which are healthful, that you choose through your purchases things like community-supported agriculture, where you have people who are growing the food for the community. You pay them for the food rather than going to the store and paying for something off the shelf that you don't know where it came from or you don't know what's in it. And that you all participate in helping to grow your own food locally. This is happening all over the world. It's all over in urban areas in the United States. You have people like Will Allen in Growing Power, who took an inner city neighborhood in Milwaukee of buildings that were falling down and cleared them off in weed-covered patches and planted food there. And now he is employing inner city youth to grow this food and empowering his community. These are the types of stories that give us hope, and these are the type of stories that we can tell each other, and we can tell each other through walking the talk, too. For example, suppose there's someone, say, in your neighborhood. You could grow, says, boy, I'd love to do this. I'd love to grow a little organic plot here in my yard. I've got lots of room, but, you know, maybe my back isn't so good. I'm a little bit old, can't do these things. Well, there are lots of young people. You could help them do that. You say, hey, look, I'll give you, you can use this land here, and I'll even give you a couple $100 for a tiller if you'll start growing things that you know, we can eat some of them. And feed the family, feed the whole community, feed the neighborhood. Let the whole neighborhood be a part of that. And that way you're supporting local people doing for each other, doing a positive thing for the community. You can do that. You could do that anywhere. You could do that in any city in the United States. And people are doing that.
Yeah, they are. And that's a cool thing about that. I want to mention real quickly, and we're talking again with Jim Pathfinder Ewing. The latest book is called Conscious Food, Sustainable Growing, Spiritual Eating. The bibliography in this book is phenomenal. It's phenomenal. Now, it represents your shamanic background, because I see several, I mean, there are several of these that are in my library too. And it's like, oh yeah, that's great. I can't say the best one. They're all great. But that I think is really a good resource for people who are wanting to become more empowered in terms of making conscious choices, understanding where this ideology comes from.
Yes, and I did that on purpose. The bibliography, I wanted people to see other books, and so they could explore different aspects of this. Food is not. See, we want to compartmentalize everything. We want food to be maybe have to file it under agriculture or file it under farmers or something like that. But the fact is that each one of us has to have food to survive, and we have we've lost the sight of the fact that food really is an intimate act. I mean, you're putting something into your body. You know, I mean, think about that for a second. You're putting something into your body, and so you should have a very good, respectful relationship with what it is that you're putting in your body. And then you consider, too, if you think back for a second, about what the importance that food has played in your life as far as communal activities. Think of all the good meals that you've had with your loved ones, maybe with your grandparents, aunts and uncles and so forth, you know, maybe at Christmas and Thanksgiving and things like that. Or maybe it could be something as simple as maybe your first love, you know, going roller skating or something and stopping and having, you know, a pop and peanuts or an ice cream cone or something, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. There's all kinds of things here that food can be and should be a very important part of our lives. And so the book, as far as the bibliography is concerned, has all the things in there that I think that at least get my thinking going, and also ways in which, you know, there are things that really are heavy duty things like Stuffed and Starved by Raj Patel, and, you know, The End of Food, which is another text. You have all kinds of Thomas Berry and Wendell Berry. There are ways in which, you know, mainstream churches are involved, like Mallory McDuff's Sacred Acts. That's a good book. There Echo Spirituality and Religion and Environment are big issues right now. There's actually a Yale forum on that, which is you can Google that, the Yale Forum on Environment and Religion. There's a huge and growing, you might call it a movement of new ways to look at food. And so I hope that the bibliography reflects that.
It will. Now, hang on. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to start with this accessing non-ordinary reality. This is where the shamanic element comes in. And I think I really like the fact that you also included that in the book, because there are other things going on with our relationship with the land and our environment and our food than we are aware, a lot of us. And you can share that. We're talking with Jim Pathfinder Ewing, Conscious Food on Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett. We'll be back.
There's a place where a total stranger will give their blood to save your life. There's a place where someone you never knew will save your child from drowning. A place where people will give you food and shelter after a flood. There's a place where, when you need it most, someone will reach out their hand, put it across your shoulder and say, "Everything's going to be okay." That place is called America, where we look out for each other. And it's up to us to keep it that way. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org today.
License and registration.
But I'm walking.
Do you want to upset an officer of the law?
No, sir.
Good. I pulled you over today for littering.
I didn't litter.
Wow. That's what they all say. Unfortunately, I saw you drop a pair of thunder thighs a few blocks back. Probably happened as you were biting into that apple you're holding.
How'd you know they're my thunder thighs?
Well, my young friend, I'd like to say 2 years in the police academy helped figure it out, but between us, it was smallstep.gov.
Smallstep.gov?
Yep, Rooney. It's this site with tons of easy ways to lose weight. Some steps are so easy, people don't realize they're doing them. Like you taking small step number 83, snack on fruits. Go to smallstep.gov, you'll see. You can drive off now.
I'm still walking.
Take a small step to get healthy at smallstep.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
People have all kinds of excuses for not saving energy. I didn't plug it in. I'll turn it off later. It's not my music. It's just one phone charger. So we don't have those Energy Star appliances. So that old window leaks. How much energy and money could the new ones really save? Maybe it's time to stop making excuses and start doing some simple things to save the energy and resources we can.
Because a little here and a little there can add up to a lot later. And you just never know what people will need in the future. My name is
Sarah, and I'm going to get started today.
We can all help save more energy for tomorrow. What's your excuse? For more energy saving tips that also save money, visit loseyourexcuse.gov/parents. This message is brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy, the Ad Council, and the station.
Hi there, and welcome back. Conscious Living on Empower Radio. I'm Wendy Garrett. Thanks for tuning in. Jim Pathfinder Ewing has a really good pedigree for doing this kind of work. He's the author, the journalist, small farmer. He's studied, written about, and taught, lectured the whole nine yards on Reiki, shamanism, spiritual ecology. He has years of doing what he is talking about right now. He practices what he preaches. And if you have not heard of him, then this book, if you're just starting here with Conscious Food, Sustainable Growing, Spiritual Eating, gives you a way of seeing the world and the reasons that our connection with food are so vital to us going forward, because our brain is functioning on what kind of fuel we're putting in. And I find the amazing thing that we want our water to be pure, but we insist on drinking 5 sodas a day. I think that's really an interesting statement of our awareness of what's going on with our bodies. You know, maybe that's just my own personal joke, but you know, it's one of those things that what are we really thinking about when we are unconsciously eating? All right. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
I appreciate your time. I wanted to focus on that other part that you include at the very end, the accessing non-ordinary reality, because I've had my own encounters and other people who have shared when they begin working the land. And one of them is Penny Kelly, who has written some really cool books about her experiences. Lily Hill Farm, the beings that she engages as she's out there doing her work. And you've had those experiences as well. And can you share how that factors in?
Okay. Let me say that I put that at the end of the book because, you know, and also noticed in the noted in the very beginning that that's where I'm coming from, because, you know, that's where the body of my work is come from. But at the very end, I put that in there so that people could learn more. Most of my books have been about that. The first book I wrote, Clearing, is about clearing the land of negative energy, and that would also be houses. And as a matter of fact, the title was A Guide to Liberating Energies Trapped in Buildings and Lands. And then let me just kind of step back here for a second about my previous book, so you can kind of get an idea.
Yeah.
And then the first book was because I'd written a book, my first book that never got published and won't be published, was basically I sat down and I wrote down everything that I'd learned from these, you know, years of trying to heal myself, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like it might be called more than anyone ever wanted to know about energy medicine. And as a matter of fact, when I submitted it to a literary agent, she read it, and that's basically what she said. She said, nobody's going to read this, Jim. It's too much, and it's not focused, and this and that and the other. So together, we kind of pared it down and came up with an outline. And so I was working on it, but not having a whole lot of success. And so she called me one day out of the blue and said, how's it coming? And I said, well, not very good. You know, I'm kind of bogged down. She said, well, what are you doing right now? And I said, well, right now I'm doing a lot of land clearing. At that time in my life, I was actually going around. I was doing it just for my own, you know, whatever. But also people were paying me to come and you know, clear their businesses and things like this. And this was a long time ago. It was 10, 15 years ago. So so I was doing that. And I was going, you know, I'd go into, you know, department stores, small stores. It'd be people. I had a lady who owned a plantation at, down in Louisiana. It's like 3,000 acres. And, you know, just doing land clearing everywhere and buildings. And things and businesses. And so I was doing a lot of that, and I said, that's what I'm doing. She said, well, why don't you write a book on that? And I said, well, okay, you know, I guess I could do that. So I sat down and I wrote it in 1 week. I sat down, and it was like 120 pages, and I wrote it. I just sat down and wrote, you know, what I was doing and everything. And so, of course, it got edited over and over and over again. But essentially the book, you know, that's what that book was. And that book, which is funny, there was, I'm not going to name names, but a major New York publisher, my agent found this major New York publisher that was going to print it. And we got all the way to the contract signing, and one of their big honchos vetoed it because, quote, it had too many unseen spirits, unquote, in it.
Wonder if there was a limit, you know, a certain limit on that.
Yeah, and I thought, well, golly, you know, that's kind of odd.
Okay, anyway, that was the point of the book. That was
Yeah. So,
duh.
So, it was, yeah, basically, yeah. I mean, it's energy medicine. So, So anyway, that one got vetoed, and at first I was kind of upset about it, but then Finhorn snapped it up, and I was real pleased. And Finhorn actually went one step further. They liked it so much that they signed me to a 4-book contract. Mm-hmm. So that's how the first 4 books came about. Basically, I was just breaking down what I was doing. And the first one was clearing, which was how to clear lands and apartments. And it's a handbook so that anybody can use it. See, a lot of people, you know, they burn candles and do incense, and they know they work, but they don't know why they work. And so that book tells why and how and all like that. So you don't have to pay.
Let me really quick make a plug for that, because right now there are a lot of people wanting, you may have been, you know, ahead of the curve by about 10 or 15 years, because there are a lot of people wanting that information and not understanding why their space is stagnant, why they're getting depressed, why they're feeling hostile at certain times. They don't understand there's something in that area that is giving them a vibe, and unknowingly they're picking up on it. So this is a really good book. You know, I know you're working with conscious food right now, and that's what we're talking about, but it's all related. And
oh,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so that book became an immediate, as far as, you know, I'm not a bestseller like John Grisham or anything like that, but as far as my little energy medicine books and so forth, that one sold very well, went through multiple editions. That one got translated English, French, German, Russian, Japanese, and a very successful book. And then, and it's still out there. I mean, I don't know what it's like in its third or fourth printing. I don't know, something like that. So, clearing is a very popular book still. I mean, it's still out there, still going. And then the next one was Finding Sanctuary in Nature: Simple Ceremonies in Native American Tradition for Healing Yourself and Others. Now, I want to point out real quick that I don't reveal any secrets in that book. There, you know, I'm very respectful of individual tribes and individual ways of doing things. But what I do give in the book are general principles and some things, some simple things that you can do as far as finding your own spirituality, and it's finding yourself. And in my way of thinking, that when you're with nature, and that's why it's called Finding Sanctuary in Nature, is that you find yourself in nature. That's yeah. where your true self is revealed. And so some of the things in there, little rituals and ceremonies, are things to help you to determine who you really are and how you know not who you think you are, but who you really are. And one of the things in that book is that, for example, you've sure heard of Vision Quest and so forth. Well, what the reason for the Vision Quest is so that you can hear Creator speak to you, and so you can see what Creator has before you, and the way you do that is stop listening to the voices of who you think you are, which is all, you know, all your life you've been told by people, authority figures like your parents and your teachers and so forth, that you're this and you're not that, do this,
a
not
projection.
That.
Yeah, projection.
Right, and so you hear this voice that says, you know, these voices that dictate who you are and what you think about things. But the reason for the Vision Quest is so that you can be out there long enough so that you can hear Creator, which is the word spoken in silence. In other words, when you no longer have those voices speaking to you, but you hear between the voices, you hear the silence, you hear the wisdom of who you really are rather than who you think you are, okay? Mm-hmm. And so that's what that book is all about, is teaching you certain things that can help you to determine who you really are and where you need to go and things like that. So then the next one was Healing Plants and Animals from a Distance, Curative Principles and Applications. And I would call that one was more my pure shamanism book, and because it's if you're into shamanism, that's the book for you, because it deals with subjects as far as things that are here and things that are there and how they don't mean anything. There's no such thing as time and space and all time, no time.
Yeah.
And it gives different ideas like that. It gives you some concepts of the universe, different shamanic ways of looking at the world, things like that, how reality is what you project upon it and things like that. It's pure shamanism.
You stick
it
as soon as you make, yeah, as soon as you make an idea or have a limiting belief, then that's how reality then molds for you, because it's very, very interactive and compliant.
Right, and the power of the voice is one of the things in there, is that, once you utter something, it lives. It's a living being. And I believe, I can't remember who the quote was, but it says, if you don't want what you say to the trees to be heard, then don't speak it to us. But if you utter something, even if it's to the trees, then you can't be angry if it gets carried by the wind, okay?
Mm,
and other people pick it up.
That
things, when you utter them, when you use your sacred breath to utter something, then it becomes a living thing. It goes out into the world and becomes a living thing.
Well, you've given birth to the vibration.
That's right. So you need to be conscious of what the things that you're creating in the world through your words, not just through your thoughts, which are also have great power, and also go out with the beating of your heart. Each time your heart beats, you are becoming one with the universe. You have the still point twice. Each time your heart beats out, each time your heart beats in, okay? At one micromillisecond of each time when your heart expands to its furthest and can go no further, and when it contracts and can go no further, there's one micromillisecond in which your heart is totally at still point. And that vibration is when you are one with everything in the universe, okay? So when you have thoughts of angry thoughts, happy thoughts, whatever thoughts they may be, when your heart is beating, you're projecting these things out into the universe every time, unconsciously, you see? And so that's why it's so important. It's so important what you think and what you say and what you do. All these things are important because you are actually a little broadcaster wherever you go, okay? You're a cell phone, only it's the cells in your body that's making these phone calls out to the universe, okay?
Yeah.
So anyway, that book is Healing Plants and Animals from a Distance. Now, that one, during the Gulf oil spill, it got real popular because it gives in their techniques for distance healing. Like in Reiki, you know, you have Hanshi Sei Shonin, the symbol, which is the long-distance symbol where you can do healing from anywhere, distance healing anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in that book, it gives different ways to do that, okay, including that way. But different ways, you know, using a medicine wheel. It goes a lot into the medicine wheel and how you can create medicine wheels for specific purposes and so forth. Anyway, that's what that book does. And then my fourth book was Reiki Shamanism, which is combining Reiki and shamanism. I came into Reiki relatively late in life. I was at a conference on shamanism, and my leg was hurting me, and the person I was with, I mentioned it. And the lady behind me said, you know, I'm a Reiki master. If you'd like, during a break, I'll work on your leg. And so I said, sure, you know, why not? You know? So during the break, she waved her hands over my leg, and the pain went away. And now, mind you, I've been walking around for like 8 years in chronic pain. It wasn't a question of if it hurt. It was a question of how much it hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And so for her to just wave her hands and the pain went away, was for me a miracle, an absolute incredible miracle. And so I said, lady, I don't know what you did, but I've got to learn how to do that. And so she said, this is Reiki, and she spelled it for me. And so then I found, you know, I immediately went online and found a Reiki teacher, and then I studied with under William Lee Rand, got and all that. And so who I credit with being, you know, he's in my mind, he's the best, you know, William Lee Rand. So anyway, so that book, but since I was coming from a background of shamanism, it naturally just kind of got sucked into shamanism, and so I wrote a book on it, and that was combining Reiki and shamanism. And so that book now is my biggest seller, and it's been translated in all those languages and gone all over everywhere. And it just keeps selling. Just, you know, keep selling. So Reiki Shamanism is to get back to your original question about non-ordinary reality, that would be the book right after Reiki Shamanism. I wrote a book that's called Dreams of the Reiki Shamanist. And, excuse me, I went for like 2 years without writing a book. And that was because I was so busy teaching classes on Reiki Shamanism because everybody wanted to learn it. And so the Dreams of the Reiki Shaman, I wanted to call it Reiki Shamanism Volume 2, but my publisher said no, and advised against it because Volume 2 is never do any good.
Yeah,
or that's the thinking. So I call it Dreams of the Reiki Shaman, but basically it's Reiki Shamanism Volume 2. So if you like, you know, if you thought Reiki Shamanism's good, then what Dreams of the Reiki Shamanism is answering all those questions that people had and explaining so that you don't have to take a course from me. You can read the book, you know. And so that's what that is. But one of the concepts in your question about non-ordinary reality is that Dreams of the Reiki Shaman goes into something which is the new part of it, and that is that I call it apprehending reality, okay? And I don't call it non-ordinary reality because I think that reality is mutable enough that it's what your definition of reality is becomes reality. And so in Dreams of the Reiki Shaman, I speak about how learning to perceive non-ordinary reality, you don't have to do it with just a drum, you know, like journeying with the drum through shamanism. Mystics and seers have been doing it for thousands of years through various ways, and it can be done through meditation. It can be done through any of a number of ways. And for example, you know, I go on a daily walk or bike ride or something like that, and I can turn it on and off. You know, it's just without any. You know, I've done it so long that it's just not hard to go in and out to decide. And that's why I think it's very important. I always stress on. Again, about that the number one rule of shamanism is discernment, and that is knowing where your energy is going, and that is to be able to realize that to go into a way of viewing non-ordinary reality needs to have a clear way of turning it on and turning it off, because otherwise you can get confused and lost and you get spacey and stuff like that. So that's why ritual is important as far as you know, going non-ordinary reality is concerned. That's why, you know, good people, you know, people, it's good for them sometimes to have a very detailed way of, you know, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to drum, and I'm going to come out of the drum, this, that, and the other. But when
ritual,
you get right down,
yeah. When you get you're right basically down, establishing a start time and an end time.
Right.
That's, I want to just emphasize that, because you're right. The spacey part, if you forget where you're at, it's more than just spacey. It can be dangerous if you're doing something that requires your full attention.
Right. Exactly. Sure. And also, it's important to be here in your body. I don't take any more clients anymore. Spirit told me to quit, and I think the reason was that I was spending more time out of my body than in my body, and you know, the reason we're here is for a purpose. You know, you know, we'll have plenty of time out of our bodies. We'll have plenty of time. You know, for me, I enjoy being in my body, frankly, and I think that's some of the techniques that I speak in some of the other books about grounding and centering and so forth are so very, very important, because you want to make sure when you journey, and I do this every time I write about journey, is that you want to make sure you come all the way back, and that means all of you, okay? All of you comes back.
Yeah.
You're not leaving any cords or whatnot, any part of you, your consciousness out there floating around anywhere or whatnot. So it's very important to learn how to be present, and that is to ground and how to center. And then also, when you're going out in the world, how to shield so that you're not taking on stuff. You don't want to take on somebody's junk, okay? So you want to keep yourself, keep your energy field clear. And actually, I did some, I've done some little YouTube-type things on that, little short two-minute things on grounding, centering, and shielding. If you go to my webpage... I mean, not on my webpage. They're on my Facebook page. But you can just Google Jim Pathfinder Ewing, and I've got a Facebook page. You can click on that, or my webpage, which is blueskywaters.com. Blueskywaters.com. But I give all about that. But anyway, non-ordinary reality, I call it apprehending reality, and you can do it. And I give some techniques on that and some instruction on that in Dreams of the Reiki Shaman, and that is how anybody can perceive non-ordinary reality. You don't have to journey. You don't have to do it. Now, of course, if you do learn how to journey, you find that just about anything can set you off. For example, I write in there about how the first time I learned that was that I put something in the washer or dryer or something. Probably shouldn't say this on the radio, but I went to go on the toilet, and I'm sitting there, and the And the dryer was going thump, 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 and next thing I knew, I'm journeying out.
So anyway, you need to be very present.
You know, you need to always know where you are and what you're doing and so forth. So it did teach me that you can journey anywhere, anytime. Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing that people, once you realize that this stuff is accessible and once you are ready for it, then you really need to have a few grounding programs in place, because I don't know, you can't be more adamant or giving more warning signs about that, because this stuff is real. It's incredibly amazing, empowering, and once you reach that level, if you don't have stoppers on, a way to attach yourself to this physical reality, you can have some experiences that you're not quite sure how to reconcile. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It makes good sense. Another thing I say is, find your power animal and don't leave home without him.
Yes, and that's a grounding. That's a way of saying I am attached to this reality, and this is my companion who'll make sure I get back home when I'm too drunk to drive.
Power animal is going to protect you and take care of you, and so forth and so on. Those are, what some people call guardian angels or power animals, whatnot. They're with you all the time. It's just a question of being open to allowing them to show you. Some people just call it intuition. But allowing these guides and angels and power animals that are with you all the time to heed them, listen to them, and acknowledge them.
Well, and see, I like the way you basically call it non-ordinary reality. I like that because it doesn't give it a bad, good, a woo-woo. It gives it it's just an altered way, an altered state, a non-local form of presence, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing is that everyone is unique and that you're seeing the world through different lenses. And that's one of the things in Dreams of the Reiki Shaman, why I explain in there how to allow yourself to be open to see things in different ways, because what my teachers taught me is to see through your spirit eyes. Okay, in other words, you can see things through your physical eyes, and they appear one way, but if you teach yourself to see things through spirit, see through your spirit eyes, then it just opens up a whole different world for you. And another aspect of that would be to not be so judgmental, not make so many critical distinctions with your mind. In other words, we go through our mind, we think that, you know, what our rational self, which is a good self, that's fine. And ego's good, there's nothing wrong with ego. I like to call it personality because ego has a lot of connotations to it. But, you know, the purpose for that is to keep you alive, and that is that your ego's there to make sure that you don't get lackadaisical about, say, lions and tigers and bears, okay? So it's very important it's there, but there's also other parts of your consciousness, too, that are always there. Your ego is like a little pea in a bushel basket rattling around. That's not who you are. You know, the ego likes to think that's who you are because the ego likes to be in charge of everything. But who you really are is multidimensional and is huge, and you're a lot more than that. And so it's starting to understand that you can think with your heart, too. That when you hear someone speaking, it's not necessary that you sit there and critically think about every word they say and find fault with it, okay? Or say, I'm better than that, or I'm worse than that, or I agree with that, or I disagree with that. You can also think with your heart, and that is to feel what the person is saying. Feel what that person is really saying. Feel it with your heart. What's that person saying? It could be that you'll come out with an entirely different dialogue. That what the person is saying may or may not be what the words are saying. It could be that the person is saying something entirely different. And so that's where you get into becoming a true, whole, real human being. There are a lot of people around, and see, this is another native concept of people with human beings, that there are a lot of people who are unconscious, who are walking around all the time, who have these thoughts in their heads. They're not really there. They're unconscious. They're in dream worlds. They're, right. They have conflicts and things are going on with them that can be hurtful to themselves and hurtful to others, but they're not really being a human being, okay? They're being something else. They're being what they think they ought to be rather than being a real human being. If you're a real human being, you live multidimensionally. You live with your heart as well as your mind. You live here as well as there. You know that things happen not only to you and around you and by you, but also apart from you. But things that happen apart from you can have great effects with you, and you find yourself connected with those things. And it becomes a delight to discover how you are connected to the world and things like that. These are ideas that are much bigger than yourself, and it becomes a joy to live rather than just plodding along a line trying to determine if what is happening is what you think ought to happen. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. There's just so much here that we really haven't tapped into in terms of reality. All right, that's it. We're going to have to wrap up, but I really appreciate your time. I'd love to speak with you again about more of your beliefs, your books, and your path. If you're listening now, you can check him out, Jim Pathfinder Ewing, at blueskywaters.com, or you can find him on Facebook and find out how he gardens as well. Okay, conscious food, sustainable growing, spiritual eating. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Wendy.